Hi, welcome to Inside Learning episode 60 for the 1st of February 2012. 20,000 leagues under the GCSE.
Good evening, Matthew. Good evening, Jay. Good to talk to you again.
Hey, Steve. Really good to hear from you. Inside Learning again. It's that time of the week. Wow.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Did the haggis survive your onslaught on Burns Night last week?
it was indeed true. Actually, as Jay was in the blue room, you know, in the Inside Learning extensive suite of recording studios, myself and Julie were guzzling haggis. Vegetarian haggis, I have to say, Steve. I know you'd approve. Specifically, the McSweeney's, for those who care. Very nice.
So it's not a tautology then, a vegetarian haggis?
Well, there are many meat eaters who choose to make a fight of this and claim that it is, but I don't think so, no. I think Rabi, with his general humanitarianism and, in fact, the man would have been a good humanist and his apologies to the creatures that we harm, I think he would have been happy enough to enfold the vegetarian haggis in his addresses.
No secret and timorous beasties on your plate.
Not at all. Although I believe some of the vegetables were carotid.
Oh dear.
Sorry about that. And more news, Jay and I worked with a group of people this week. Nice to actually be in the same room together. And I think listeners should know that one of them more or less gasped in horror and said to him, "Wow, you look younger than you sound."
Younger than you sound.
Did I get that the right way around, Jay?
Yes, yeah. You did. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Like, well, well, I think listeners should know that Jay brings up the youth wing of Inside Learning. So
that's right, and that takes us to the figures. Big thank you to everyone for all the help you've given us last month, and presumably sharing and telling people to listen to the podcast, because we broke records again massively. In fact, I think I might even put up a graphic on the Facebook page that you put up, Jay, just to let people see the growth curve is just frightening. It's actually, I can't tell whether it's linear or just starting to become exponential. It's difficult. Somewhere in between, but we very, very close to 2,000 episodes downloaded equivalent last month, so that's fantastic. But can we put out our usual plea? You know, we've been on 18 months. We've been honest enough. Please, listeners, wait till I get my appeal voice. Please, listeners, we've been honest enough not to go to your wives and partners and friends and say, "Will you go on and put on a review for us on iTunes?" But I looked at iTunes and we've got a couple of the episodes are starting to show bars, which usually indicates popularity in those episodes. But no one's put a review. We've got no star rating or anything. You would really help us to grow if you could. You know, if you do enjoy the podcast, go on, give us a line or two, or at least just go on and click the star rating and give us what you think. We would so appreciate that.
Oh, put a comment on our front page. I know we've been talking, Matthew and Jeremy, about expanding in the future. I know we're awfully busy because we do other work besides immersing ourselves in Inside Learning, but looking at ways that maybe we can expand the site in terms of file sharing and linking people together more.
Yeah. File sharing is one of the things we'd really like, because, you know, we have a community of listeners. We know that now, and it's a large and growing community, so they might want to share some stuff with each other. So we're pretty much undertaking to do that soon. If people look on the site, they can see the experimental area on the right-hand toolbar. At the moment, it just takes you to a password-protected area, but that's coming very soon. We just need to find the right tool.
Right.
Yeah. Another thing we would love, I think, is to find... It was good to hear Bev podcasting from an excellent episode that incidentally last week. Very, very frustrating not being part of it, but brilliant to listen to. But good to hear someone podcasting from Wales. You know, so if you're out there listening to us and you've got good views on education in Wales or connections, you know, get in touch with us and we'll start to bring you on as a regular guest. As a UK podcast, you know, I think we underrepresent Wales.
Yeah, and
sure.
Northern Ireland as well.
Yes, the thought did occur to me there. I thought, yep. Actually, for that matter, you know, as a British Isles one, we could go for the Republic too. Yeah. Do they still call it that? Is it the Republic of Ireland or is it just Ireland? We're not making a good start on appealing to the Irish audience here, are we?
Anyway, we've got a new...
It's Michael Mac. I've just finished. I can't resist. It's even Michael McIntyre's autobiography. I just read that or listened to it on Audible. He said, you know, the old jokes about the Irish being thick. He said, I don't want to play to them, but it's striking. He said that they've just called their island an island, but misspelled it. I thought that was very cruel.
Okay, well, that's one way of getting folks from Ireland to
the front. A beautiful place with fantastic people.
And we're discussing news tonight. So, Matthew, would you like to start us off?
Yeah, I was totally ready for that in every regard. Except, actually, Steve, I believe that there was a possibility we may end up with similar stories. So does it matter if I go first?
No.
Okay. What caught me was one of those stories that just had me, you know, with my jaw on my chest. You may have read the flurry of stories this week because the English league tables have been published. It's not a specifically English story, although the data is located there. It turns out that if you're below average attainment levels when you start secondary school in England, it doesn't change. You reach the end and the government's 5 GCSEs at A to C target, you don't manage. And in fact, there's one figure, I'm just scrolling down to look for this. Out of, where are we here? 909 schools, get this, 909 schools, not one low attaining pupil. And that's defined, Steve, as those who didn't reach level 4 at the end of primary school. Not one of them out of those schools reached the threshold of 5 GCSEs. And what struck me about that is the myth. We have a myth that does the rounds in education. We kind of believe it, that you know, the kids that aren't doing well at the end of primary, you know what, if they work hard and they work with us, you know, some of them get through and, you know, turn the game around. 909 schools says, no, they don't. Can you imagine if I was to sell to you guys? Come on, come in my training course. Just a couple of years long, you know. I have to tell you, though, right away, that if you're not good at the start, you'll be crap at the end, you know. But really, I want you to commit a few years to this training course. Great course, really good. Scores well in the league tables, as long as you're bright. I think it's unbelievable. It's a shocker.
It is. And did you correlate those figures with disadvantage and social inequalities and poverty?
I have to say, I personally didn't, but the piece absolutely did, Steve. Yeah. No surprise, those who were on free school meals, which is still the standard measure of disadvantage. I can't remember the data, I'm kind of looking for it, but they were significantly represented in the group who didn't make the 5 GCSEs. There's no doubt that that's still a hugely powerful indicator of lack of success at the end.
Yeah.
I'll maybe come back to where you guys are chatting. So I'm just looking to see what that data was. I'm sure it did say that.
Well, it did. And it's been the case for some time. And it doesn't seem to be... I don't think it seems to be getting any better from the evidence I've seen. You know.
Oh, I've got the data, if you don't mind me cutting in. Sorry, it took me a wee moment there. It's those who have the free school meals or they're in local authority care, out of them, only one third... achieve the government's benchmark of 5 GCSEs at A to C. Only a third of them. So if you've got that kind of disadvantage to start off with, it doesn't seem that the education system is able to overcome that for you.
No.
That's quite frightening statistics, isn't it? Or they are quite frightening statistics. When you couple that with the fact that some free schools now and academies have the ability to change their catchment area. There was a story in one of the papers today, I can't remember the exact school, but it was down in London area, and they've tweaked the boundaries by point something of a mile to specifically exclude two estates, or two, you know, housing estates. Obviously, it's not put like this, but the fear is, and the watchdogs looked into it, that they are deliberately excluding children who have low attainment because of low socioeconomic factors, and therefore it's going to boost their league table standings.
Combine that with the story that we had a few weeks ago about the academies, you know, basically getting rid of people by putting pressure on them to choose another school that's more suitable for them. It's gerrymandering again writ large, isn't it?
Well, it is, and in theory, the system is quite clear. You know that there is an emissions policy, and you have to follow the emissions policy, and it is aimed to cut that kind of, as you called it, gerrymandering out. But schools seem to be finding ways around it. And he said there is something systemically quite sort of, I was going to say rotten a bit, but because obviously there's a large number of young people who do succeed in school, but there's a cohort that we're continually failing. And what ministers tend to do is say, well, you know, poverty is not an excuse. You know, look at blah, blah school. They deal with the poor catchment area. They're doing very well. So if they're doing very well, why can't everyone else doing very well? But nobody seems to want to tackle some of the systemic issues around poverty. You know, that we know young people from disadvantaged backgrounds will always start off their educational life behind others. And we've not really learned.
That's two-thirds of them, you know, so from that data, two-thirds of them, just if they've got free school meals in English schools, you are going to predict are not going to do well out of the system. It's amazing, yeah. And in the middle of all that, one of the things I'm really motivated about just now is school growth and change. I'm trying not to make that sound as if it's criticism of what we have in school just now, because I'm very clear that in schools we've got hardworking staff. I know someone was on the news in the last couple of days. I saw the clip, embedded clip in the website, defending that, you know, saying, you know, teachers feel attacked by these statistics. And I think it's really important to say the vast majority of teachers are doing the best. As John Macbeth always says, it's amazing how they bend over backwards to make a bad system work well, you know, and they care and they do what they can. Yeah. But when we talk about changing schools, you know, and developing, you know, maybe a significantly different approach that really worked for some of these people that clearly the current model leaves behind, you get you get the same tired old phrase, you can't experiment with kids' lives. Yeah. But we've got this data that out 900 schools that were looked at, in 909 schools, that's it. I'm not sure whether that means they only looked at 909. I need to dig into that data, or whether it just means that there were 909 schools. But in that, not one changed their game.
Mm. When it talked about GCSE results, Matthew, as the benchmark for achievement at the end of secondary school, did it take into account, GCSE equivalents, vocational courses that are equivalent to a certain number of GCSEs, or was it strictly academic GCSEs?
This particular article, I don't think, said that. Steve, did you say anything about it?
No, I didn't. Are you leading on to the story I think you're going to lead on to here, Jay?
Well, do you know, I wasn't going to cover it because I've read a couple of articles, but I don't know enough. It's the Wolf Report, isn't it?
Yes, because we covered it last year, but I think there's a theme emerging here in this program tonight, and from what you've mentioned, Jay, and from what Matthew's raised, is the way that schools are made accountable seems to be skewing our education system. As you said, as John Macbeth said, you know, teachers are bending over backwards to make a bad system work. And currently we have a system that the driver for improvement in our system has been built around competition. And competition leads to failure in some parts, doesn't it? Because in order for some to succeed, others have got to fail. And kind of failure has been used as a sort of driver. And the way to bring competition in the system that both New Labour and Tory governments promoted is publicly accountable data. This is what these league tables all are about. They're about providing parents with the notion of choice. So, of course, if you're put into a competitive situation, you're going to sort of try and pull off every trick in the book, in a sense, to bring yourself up the league table. So in effect, what you've got is schools trying to be effective against the league tables rather than trying to be excellent against virtues or morals of a good education. You know, it's bound to distort the system. And the story I was going to bring in was, again, it was about the announcement from the department today about the shake-up of what's going to be included in the league tables in 2014. Because apparently there were more than, what Alison Wolfe was saying, was there more than 3,000, over 3,100 various vocational qualifications being taken in schools. And these have been used to compile up points for schools to boost themselves on the league table. So the department is having a big shake-up of those qualifications, and they're going to only include 70 of them. And they're only going to be the equivalent of those 70 approved courses, qualifications, will only be the equivalent of one GCSE. I believe some of them, for example, would be equivalent of three or four GCSEs in the past. And of course, what the media have picked up on is all things like, you know, fish husbandry and nail care and horse care and
so on. Horse grooming is the one that I've seen three newspaper articles and on the Today programme.
I know, but it's...
fish husbandry shouldn't be allowed. Ridiculous.
You see, but it's immoral. It's polarised the debate, because what Gove says, you know, says, oh, these courses have lack of rigour. And basically, it set up this kind of...
Well, incidentally, 15 minutes. It took 15 minutes before you mentioned the Govester. Oh, sorry, carry on.
Yeah, well, I've got to. Glug, glug, glug. Because it's set up as the kind of notion is, oh, vocational courses, wasted time, academic courses, rigorous, robust, you know, blah, and so on. But actually, that wasn't what I took Alison Wolfe to be saying. I mean, she was saying that, you know, vocational education is very important, but the stuff that we're giving young people in order for schools to move up the league tables isn't actually useful to young people. In fact, she's accused the system of lying to young people by saying, well, if you do these vocational courses, you'll be more employable. In fact, employers don't value them at all, some of them. So, but it's, again, it's polarized the debate. It's kind of shunted vocational education off into the sidelines again, unfortunately.
And just at a time when we couldn't need that more. One of my colleagues at work was conducting a debate with the team I'm part of, and the German system was mentioned again, you know, with the ease with which they managed to achieve, you know, not just equity, but something beyond that, you know, a sort of pride in people doing well in a vocational stream. And people that do well in an academic stream, you know, and it's something we don't have here. We have a real sort of class view of achievement and attainment, don't we?
Yeah, I mean...
Well, it's snobbery, really, isn't it? There was an article in The Guardian online I was reading today. I can't remember the name of the reporter, but she was quoting John Humphreys from the Today programme, you know, when he had a head teacher on, and he scoffingly said, you know, you don't have high attainers in your school, you know, kids who are... posh or from a good background, you know, and she was saying that this automatic equation, I don't know whether you listened to the episode of the Today programme, but he kind of trailed off and thought, and you know, you could almost hear him thinking, Craig, I put my foot in the here, but that equating the automatic equation of high academic attainment with class or with, you know, a certain class of families. And I think there's an awful lot of snobbery that surrounds the idea of vocational versus academic.
Yeah, to be fair, I mean, to be fair to Gove, I mean, he does see that snobbery in the system in the sense that actually he's saying, well, why do we always, you know, think that young people from disadvantaged backgrounds can't do academic qualifications? You know, to be fair to him, there's a kind of sense of challenge to the system in it. But, you know, what... Some years ago, when we had, I don't know if you remember, Mike Tomlinson's report, and we had an opportunity to seriously look at the equivalence between academic and vocational qualifications to sort of rationalise the whole thing. Because at one time, you know, the whole thing about the NVQs, the National Vocational Qualifications, you know, if it gave you a level, like level two, whatever you did should be equivalent right across the board, whatever qualificational route you were going down, you know, if you achieved a certain level, it should have an equivalence. And that's never been kind of systematically, I think, modelled all the way through the system. And Blair, apparently, I mean, I think John Macbeth told us this story, you know, Blair was kind of responding, going to
driving to a presentation, yeah.
And he heard, you know, the Tory kind of spokesman. I can't remember who it was at the time. Was it Michael? What's his name? Sorry, my memory.
You're going to impress me if you remember. Yeah, I know. Was it Patton or was Patton earlier?
No. It was the guy with glasses. I remember my memory's gone. But anyway, but heard that he was going to kind of defend A levels as the gold standard. So Blair kind of changed his mind in the back of the taxi because.
So yeah, we don't want to be vulnerable in that. I'll just change party policy now.
Yeah.
It's scary. Actually, it strikes me there's two things here, though. You know, one is the parity between the academic and the vocational streams, but the other one is the perverse indicators, you know. So the Govmeister may well be saying, I think quite rightly, you know, that, you know, it's not right to think that you can't bring people from poor areas into academic streams. That's right. But it's his own... allowing of the league tables only pointing out the kind of 5 A to C's, GCSEs and stuff like that, that is actually the perverse indicator that stops schools focusing on those kind of youngsters that don't make it, because they throw all their resources after those that are that are a hot ticket to get that.
That's right. And then what do you do with young people who are totally switched off school, you know?
Well, if you're busy pushing up your league table results, you don't have the energy or resources in your teachers to do that, because the teachers are, you know, it's not as if the teachers are a huge mixture of academic and vocational people. They're basically academic who turn their hand to supporting vocational approach. I mean, that's another problem that we don't really tackle often enough, the balance of the staff in most schools, you know, they're middle class and they're generally, I know it's a generalisation, but they're probably still by and large successes of the system.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're not the people to drive this change in some ways.
I mean, I was listening to a head in an interview, I can't remember which station it was on, but it might have been Radio 5 Live, actually. I was driving and, I mean, he sounded very measured about it, in the sense he said, well, you know, I have a star achieving a level, on track to get A's at A level, but, you know, we also make sure that they've got routes to all sorts of courses that actually engage and interest them in other ways, you know, apart from the academic. And he had quite a measured approach to it. So there seems to be, but I guess some schools feel that because of the pressure of the league tables, they've really got to focus on getting those A to C, so everything's kind of geared towards that distorted curriculum.
Absolutely. If I could bring in something linked, I hope it doesn't steal any stories, but just briefly, the 27th of January, last week's Times Educational Supplement Scotland, the editorial talked about, you know, what we should be focusing on just now. A very good editorial, I thought. It basically points out that 1 in 4 of 16 to 24 year olds in Scotland are already out of work. What's urgent just now is skills for life and work, employability skills, so-called soft skills or softer skills, as they call it, for life and work, stickability, commitment, team working, timekeeping, good communication, confidence, etc. Again, the perverse targets of the perverse incentives, sorry, of the league table targets, they don't move us towards this.
No. Well, the thing that Ken Robinson was talking about, you know, about the element and about people trying to find their passion in life, you know, well, you know, you've got to allow people to kind of engage with learning in some passionate level, haven't you?
Absolutely.
I think I just found a statistic that Alison Wolfe brought up in her report about the proliferation of these courses. Apparently in 2004, there was something around about 15,000 young people were doing these kind of vocational additional qualifications, and that number has gone up to now is well over 500,000. That's a huge increase, you know. And she puts that proliferation down to the pressure on schools to try and find courses that give them league point points for the league tables.
My goodness.
Yeah, Jay. Sorry, we've kind of talked a long time over this one, and we've ignored your story so far.
Well, we've lost you.
I thought it was quiet.
I was quietly trying to just sort of bring him back on in the background there without pointing out to the audience that he's dropped out. Skype is just automatically trying to bring him back online. I think he should pop in a wee moment. So we'll need to press on without him until he reappears. I'll keep redialing in the background.
There is a huge systemic problem, isn't it? And we just, what we do is we ask teachers, creative people, to work harder and harder, and there's a limit to how hard they can work.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, well, so did you have another story in the meantime?
Well, it was just an inkling of one, and that came out in The Guardian. Sir David Bell, who used to be the kind of top civil servant in the Department for Education, just sort of quietly saying that he's got no principal objection to profit-making companies taking over state schools. So,
right.
And they'll probably be allowed to do so eventually. So I think things are being softened up for companies to be able to come in and make profits out of education.
Yeah. How do you feel about that? You know, it's one of these things that there's a rhetoric about, but, you know, there's also practicalities about.
Well, I feel desperately angry about it in some ways because it changes the norms. You know, people think, people look at the market and competition as a neutral, rational mechanism, but it isn't. It carries different norms with it to that of the kind of norms that we might value in a kind of more civic arrangement, I think. There was an interesting, and it's in Michael Sandel's book, Justice, there was an interesting story he tells about, I might have told this one some time ago on the podcast, but he tells a story about a nursery provision where the teachers were getting a bit kind of frustrated because parents were turning up late all the time to collect their children. So they decided to fine parents. So if you turned up late to collect your child from nursery, you were fined. And in fact, the level of lateness went up, increased.
Right.
Because people thought, oh, well, actually, I'm paying for a service now. So, you know, rather than feel guilty or make an effort to accommodate or so come to some arrangement with the nursery, they treated it as a service which they paid for. It kind of changed the norms of the relationships, and I think that's what you know, the kind of privatization of education will do, because it changes the norm, the civic norm of a trust between kind of wider society and the individual, to one of, well, actually I'm paying for a service here, somebody's making a profit out of it. I was talking to a university lecturer who said, you know, I get students coming in now saying, oh, do I have to read the book? You know, can't you just give me the notes? Kind of more or less implying, well, because I'm going to be paying £9,000 for your course, I don't really want to put any work in.
Yeah. This is a difficult one. I struggle with this because I'm sympathetic with everything you've said. You know, I want education to be something that's, you know, that's pure, you know, that's about, you know, trying to help others and, you know, pulling our shared resources for the good of others. But my worry about it is that the monolithic nature of the system that we've got is stifling innovation, you know. So I'm broadly against it, I suppose. But in instances, I wouldn't only make an exception, I would actually welcome it. You know, those KIPP schools in New York, you know, if they're running as businesses, but they're achieving success, well, I'm okay with that. Yeah, as long as it's successful, that's the thing. But of course, successful for people who, you know, who don't at the moment achieve success. That's the problem. The most of the private and you know, sort of profit making models that we have don't serve the poor. That's the problem with it.
And those schools, some of those schools achieve success because they kick out the ones that cause them trouble. So, you know, and if you're a profit making company, your bottom line is to your shareholder. So you've got to turn a profit, and if actually that you've got a group of young people who are getting in the way of your capital flow, what do you kick them out, or you
supposing you make the, you know, the incentive that you get paid for, the attainment of that group that we just talked about from the 900 schools, you know, supposing you could make it that you only get your profits if you turn those round, would you then turn innovation and that same kind of bloody-minded determination onto those groups?
You might do. I could see a short-term gain there. I'd be worried about the long-term kind of, you know, effect, because because over the long term, actually, the only way you make profit is by driving down costs, you know. And where do you drive down costs? Well, usually they're the greatest cost in an institution is staff. So you start to skimp on staff, you know, over the longer term. And if the state sort of is actually responsible for the incentives and the state says, well, actually, we're not going to put as much money in this year, then, you know, you drive down costs. And the first port of call is staffing, you know, the quality of your teaching. So I think it's a very slippery road. I really do.
Well, I'm keeping my mind open. I certainly wouldn't like to see the whole system shoved to a profit system, but I would like to. I would like to see some creative incentives put in for people to achieve. I know Gove did something like that about attracting people. You know, you'd get a sum for your school. We covered this a while ago, didn't we? If you attracted FME type children under placing requests, but it was so bizarre and tiny a gesture. You know, what I would like to see is a school that's in an area that has those kind of young people, you know, that are really not doing well academically year in, year out, and that you start giving the school profit incentives that are real, you know, huge. In fact, probably like half of its income, that kind of thing, on the basis of of a set of targets for those young people. I'm not saying it would work, and I agree with you that maybe in the long term it's not the way to go. But you know, my continued horror for the logjam that we've got just now, nothing seems to change what we're doing. So I'm kind of up for trying some radically different things, but only in little pockets, Steve, to learn from.
Yeah, no, I kind of share your sense of urgency. I think probably the solutions lie institutional level, that you have to give professionals the space to think about what is it they're trying to do. And at the moment, all they're trying to do is get their 5A to C's. Now, surely there's got to be other measures of what excellent education is about. And unless we come to some agreement, and I think probably this maybe has to be done on a school-by-school basis. You know, it won't necessarily be the same for every community or every school, but unless you've got some wider agreement about, you know, what does excellence in education look like? Now, some schools seem to be able to create that, and others don't. So, I mean, I don't know. Yeah,
I know. I know it's a difficult one, isn't it? Yeah.
So, listeners, if you have
some good ideas,
flags to burn out there, some burning ideas, please let us know and join the debate. But we desperately need innovation, don't we? That's what we're saying.
Absolutely. And you know, for me, I don't have an ideological stance. If it comes through a profit motive, or it comes through, you know, a service motive, I don't really mind. But I can see strong arguments for both, and by no means am I attacking the service motive. You know, but one of the examples that we've got is that schools, you know, in Scotland, just refuse. Over the years, we've known that we pay a lot of high salaries to people in senior management positions who do pretty low level tasks, you know, instead of leading from the front and, you know, example teaching and stuff like that, you know. So I wonder whether, if it was a private business, whether the director of the school rather than the head teacher would allow that, you know. I wonder if you know, things like that evolve because of tradition, habit and structure, not obviously ever through bad intent, and just a little bit of new incentive, you know, because it's okay to say that we need creativity and we need some, you know, some fast change, you know, but actually I haven't really seen where it's going to come from.
I mean, I think in relation to your point, one of the issues we've had is actually the obsessive and almost pathological speed of change in the English English education system, probably in the UK education system. So, for example, you know, when I was a head, you know, when you're a head teacher in the early days, actually you were a head teacher, you were teacher, head teacher, and then you became head bursar. You know, I mean, when you had local management of schools, great, you had to give schools autonomy and so on. I mean, change the landscape, but actually you were talking about a very different kind of skill sets. So the kind of the focus for a while had been on the kind of, if you like, the managerialism of education and public service. So you got sort of leaders who had to become managers rather than excellent teachers.
Yeah.
I don't know the kind of research in this, but it strikes me one of the interesting experiments that New Labour came up with, and I don't know where it went, is the kind of advanced skills teachers. I mean, that seemed to me quite an interesting idea.
So yeah, and we have
really excellent
a Scottish parallel in the chartered teachers, which we've talked about a lot in this programme. But you're right, are the advanced skill teachers still around? Does that exist?
Well, I don't think the funding is there but I think the kind of, you know, I think they can get extra points for being an advanced skills teacher. I'm a bit out of touch, but the whole idea was that you took someone who was really excellent in the classroom and you supported them, and then they could go out and model and help other schools. So in fact, you know, schools could get a sort of income stream from selling their services out, but actually, rather than promote those people up the chain to become leaders and department heads and sort of bureaucrats, if you like, you know, you kept them in the classroom where they were doing the best work.
Absolutely. Although, you know, I suppose the De Bono-esque, or turn it on its head and see what happens for creativity, would say, so, you know, why is it that promoting people up the chain means that they come out of the classroom anyway? You know, perhaps if we just promoted people and had, you know, had the bursar kind of model where the school is run by a business manager, but all of the education in the school is run by the teachers, and the promoted ones run education and they lead from the front by example.
Yes.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I think creative schools are doing that. I mean, I came across a school in up in Cheshire Way, which kind of had kind of formed a federation, a secondary with the Federation of Primaries. And I think they were going to draw another secondary into it. But they'd gone to a kind of action research model of developing their teacher. The head was passionate about young people being engaged in lessons, you know, developing this independent learning. He said, you know, I can walk into a lesson and I can sense if it's a good lesson, not because I've got a clipboard and a whole list of criteria, but because I can see the way that children are asking questions and looking at the teacher and so on, you know. And he brought in these kind of, he was looking at Japanese work study methods, you know, where the Japanese had teams about specific issues that pulled teams from various parts of a plant together to look at a work issue. And he was doing the same in his school.
There's a name for those teams, isn't there? If you just remember them. Yeah.
Yeah. So there are creative people out there who can lead in different ways, you know.
I agree. But our conservatism in the system with a small c just stifles it. Anyway, I suppose we shouldn't do it to death. Can we squeeze in a 1 minute story?
Yeah, of course
story?
We can. Yeah, we've lost Jay.
I was just going to say that there. Yeah, he's offline completely, so I can't even get him back now. I don't know what's happened. It seems to be an internet connection issue. So, Jay, we're really sorry. It's like, remember that episode way back in the between 10 and 20 or something like that, when we did the same to you, we cut the rope and we let you go. Well, I think he's Joe Simpson, you know, from Touching the Void tonight. It's his turn. I just thought it was worth mentioning, I would have done last week if I'd been on Gordon Brown's call for the Global Fund for Education. You know, we've talked Scotland, we mainly talked England, a little bit of Scotland. I thought it was a very laudable request.
Week.
Yeah, did you read this? Oh, did you talk about it last week? I listened to this as well and I missed it. I'm so sorry. Right, forget that I brought that up. Okay.
No, because I remember saying that to, I think Bev brought it out, and but it's very laudable. I was saying that actually Brown had got a very bad press and quite unfairly sometimes.
Yeah, well, that was the story, wasn't it? The amount of people, Jay's online again. The amount of people who actually focused on Gordon Brown on the BBC site, you know, people started commenting on stop focusing on people abroad and, you know, fix the mess that you made with your government. You know, he seems to have figured who polarises people. Lots, I mean, I didn't rate him much as a leader of the Labour Party personally, because I guess I've accepted the real politic these days, that if you can't engage people, you know you can't lead in a media age.
Unfortunately, yes.
Absolutely, unfortunately, yeah. But I think this is utterly laudable, and I think it shows the good heart of the man. I think he probably has always been a guy. I mean, he was an architect of what New Labour tried in terms of redistribution and stuff. You know, so I think the guy's heart is exactly the right place. 13 billion. Yeah. Across the world, and the point that he made was that, you know, these are young people in countries that can become radicalised if they're not educated. It can actually be very good value for the rest of the world to contribute to a basic education for them. Sorry about that. I genuinely did listen to that. It's astonishing. I must have just not really focused on that aspect of it. Oh dear. Can I get in one final thing? I'm just going to try one last dial here at Jay, desperately trying to bring him on board. I just wanted to thank someone. Our website, sorry, I'm just going to talk web for 30 seconds here. Our website is built on WordPress, which is a blogging platform, of course, that I know a lot of schools use. I know that the Scottish Glow intranet uses it, and the new versions of it will also use that. We use a theme on top of it that lets us customise it and put in colours and tools and widgets and things that make our website work, including delivering the podcast to iTunes. It all went awry. I updated it to ProPhoto 4. This is a commercial company that write this. I think it's 4 or 5 work for the company, an American company. And I just want to give them big thanks online. If you guys are looking for a theme out there, you know, for your own personal blog or website, ProPhoto, you'll find if you just do a search, PRO Photo. It is targeted at photographers, but to be honest, the blog is their blog theme is so customizable, you can use it for anything. Well, I put in other third-party things because our podcast... plugin didn't work. I put in a new one. I didn't know, but it messed up the podcast. It messed up everything, and I ended up spending a long time trying to fix it. In the end, I emailed these guys, and their director, Jared, actually got back in touch and said, look, give me your login, if you don't mind, if you trust me, sort of thing, and I'll go in and I'll search. He ferreted around. The next day, I had an email from him saying, here's the problem. It was your JavaScript being pulled down by this other third-party plugin. It wasn't his company's. He pointed out how I could disable it and then re-enable it, you know, and how to replace it. I just want to say that's great service, isn't it? You know, that's I paid good. 30 yep. quid or something like that for this piece of software, and you don't, you know, a guy's time, you know, who's the director of that company. I am so impressed with them, and I know a lot of our listeners won't be web designers, but ProPhoto WordPress web theme, I would utterly endorse it, and their service levels are fabulous. Thank you.
Big thumbs up then to the developers. Yeah. Right, so I think we probably well run out of time here, Matthew.
We've run out of time and run out of people.
Ran away with that.
Absolutely. Nothing else to be said then?
No, I think we said we'd say goodnight on Jay's behalf.
Do you want one last go? He's now looking fully online.
Is he? Is he looking forlorn?
Hang on. Right, here we go. Last attempt. I guess we have to, just in case. Right, last dial. If this doesn't work, we watch him slide into the icy crevasse and we say goodnight. Eh?
The wheel of fortune revolving on the screen.
No, it's revolving in mine too, but we're not getting answers, are we?
Well, we better say goodnight.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, Jay. Steve, yep. Really great to talk with you tonight. And we did talk beforehand about getting Writer Girl back on next week. So if you're listening, yes. Anne, it's time we had you back in the cast.
Indeed.
See you soon.
Good night.
Thanks, Steve. Bye.
I believe Jay's joined us just in time to say goodnight, Jay.
Yeah, just in at the death.
Ah, Jay, we tried so hard to bring you back on, and we just got the message handed in an envelope that your internet connection had gone down totally.
Well, I'm so sorry I missed the rest of that conversation, guys, but I'll enjoy listening to it. I'll save my stories until next week.
Yeah, I think we might be calling this one Touching the Void 2 after the last episode when we dumped Steve unceremoniously. I think this was your turn tonight.
Well, we better say goodnight again.
Okay. Sorry, Jay. Good to hear you anyway. Good night.
Good night, guys.